This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more details, see jodcast.net.
Well, the nights are drawing in. Better for us astronomers, I think. What can we see in September? Quite an interesting month, in fact. Well, we see for quite a long time in the southwest the stars that make up the constellations of Cygnus the Swan, Lyra the Lyre, and Aquila the Eagle, with their bright stars Deneb, Vega, and Altair. I've talked about these quite a bit in the last few months, so if you want to learn more about those, just go back and click on an earlier Jodcast. So let's concentrate a bit on the stars that are now becoming visible sort of towards the southeast in the early evening and round to the south late on. Well, perhaps pride of place goes to Pegasus, the winged horse, with the square of Pegasus fairly high in the sky. Pegasus, you might know, is upside down, so the mane and the head of Pegasus drops down and round and curves up to the right from the lower right star of the square of Pegasus. If you start at the top left-hand star of the square of Pegasus, it's actually Alpha Andromedae, so it's not actually in Pegasus at all. You curve up to the left one bright star, curve a bit more to a second one, which is in fact Beta Andromedae. At that point, turn sharp right. Move one reasonably bright star, not quite so distant away. And then if you carry on by just the same amount, with binoculars on a clear night, and even with your unaided eye, if it's very clear, you should see a fuzzy glow. And what you'll be seeing is the central part of the wonderful galaxy, the Andromeda Galaxy M31. And it's perhaps the furthest that most people can see with their unaided eyes. It lies at about 2.5 million light years away. So you're looking back into time, 2.5 million years. Another way to find Andromeda is to start with the W-shaped constellation of Cassiopeia, which is above and basically above it. If you take the three bright right-hand stars that form a bit of a V, a pointer, they point down roughly towards M31 as well. So that's two ways of finding it. So do try and have a look on a clear night sometime this month. It's a lovely thing to look at. A pair of 8 by 40 or 10 by 50 binoculars on from a dark location can really show it stretching several degrees across, not just the central core, which is what we normally see from a light-polluted location. If you take the central star of Cassiopeia and sort of work leftwards to the next bright star and keep on going, you're going towards the constellation of Perseus. And about halfway between, you come to a rather lovely little group of clusters. It's called the double cluster of Perseus, or in Perseus. And that's a beautiful object in either reasonably powerful binoculars or a small telescope. In fact, you need a small telescope because a big telescope will tend to have too small a field of view to capture both of the clusters together. Down below the bright star Alpha Persei is a star called Algol. It's actually called the demon star because it appears to wink. And the reason is it's actually called what's called an eclipsing binary. And every few days, a star comes in front of the brighter star, the companion comes in front of the brighter star, and the brightness drops quite significantly. And you can easily see that happen over a period of a few hours. Finally, just below Pegasus, it's not a particularly bright region or region where there are lots of bright stars, but there is the circuit of Pisces, the head of one of the two fishes. And just below that at the moment is in fact the planet Uranus, which we'll come back to in the highlights. Down to the lower right of that Pisces circlet is Aquarius, and to the left is Cetus. So, quite a lot to see, and as the lights get longer, if you're prepared to stay up, you have a lovely view of a lot of the sky over perhaps 6 or 7 hours. Okay, well, what about the planets? Well, we'll start with Jupiter, because that's perhaps the most prominent planet, certainly in the evening sky. It's easily visible and dominates the southeastern sky after sunset. Its magnitude is dropping fractionally from about minus 2.8 to minus 2.7. The angular size, 48 arc seconds, pretty much as big as it gets, and that means a small telescope will in principle show quite a bit of detail. But as I've said before, at the present time, Jupiter is rather low in the ecliptic. It never rises much above 25 degrees above the horizon in the south. So the atmosphere does have a slightly debilitating effect. I was actually down in Rio for a big conference a week or so ago, and it was lovely to see Jupiter much higher in the sky. Well, what about Saturn? It's virtually lost in the sun's glare, which is a pity because on September the 4th, its ring system becomes edge-on to the sun and therefore is not illuminated. That's at a time when it's, in the past, certainly people have discovered small satellites close in to Saturn because the glare of the rings wasn't there. Now, it is just possible if you get yourself a very good low western horizon and look about 8 p.m. with binoculars after you have seen the sunset. Don't start looking in that direction until the sun has set, and sweep around the horizon not far from where the sun has set, a little bit to the left. Then there's a chance you might actually pick up Saturn, but that'll be the last time for a little while when it reappears in the pre-dawn sky. Well, Mercury, that actually passes behind the Sun, we call that inferior conjunction, on the 20th September. And that means it's not really visible until the very, very end of the month, and then with difficulty, I think. If you have a look on the 30th, just about 0600 BST, you will see it 10 degrees below the planet Venus, but it'll only be just above the horizon, and you'll need binoculars, I think, to pick it out. But it is, in principle, visible at the very end of the month. Well, Mars is the other interesting planet. That's becoming more prominent in the morning sky. It rises at about midnight during the month. That stays fairly constant, actually, because of the way it's moving in the sky. It lies in the constellation of Gemini, and at the beginning of the month, it's very close to the open cluster M35, which is a nice cluster down towards the bottom of Gemini. At the bottom right. The magnitude is slowly increasing, gets up to plus 0.8, and the angular size goes from about 5.8 to 6.6 arc seconds during the month. This means that towards the end of the month anyway, a small telescope under good seeing conditions might have a reasonable chance of seeing some of the more prominent features such as Syrtis Major and maybe the polar caps. Now, the Earth is beginning to overtake Mars on what we might say the inside track, so over the next few months it will be getting closer to us and we'll have a better view. Well, I've just mentioned Venus. It will be above Mercury at the end of the month. It's now moving towards the far side of the Sun. We see it, in fact, in the pre-dawn sky, so it's getting closer in angle, less easy to see. So we see it best at the beginning of September, and it's in the constellation of Cancer, and just below the Beehive Cluster at the beginning of the month. It moves down towards Leo during the month, and by the 20th, it's just half a degree above the brightest star in Leo, which is called Regulus. Look like a little double star system, in fact, although they're actually about half a degree apart, a bit more than a typical double. And a small telescope will show a waxing gibbous disk, which drops from 12.5 to about 11 arc seconds as it's moving away from us. Magnitude stays pretty constant. It's minus 3.9 throughout the whole month. Okay, well, that's a bit about the planets. What about some of the highlights of the month? Well, there are actually quite a few. Around the new moon, which is on the 18th of September, that's when the skies are darkest, if it's clear, you do have a reasonable chance of finding the planet Uranus and maybe even spotting the asteroid Juno. Uranus is at opposition on September the 17th, about new moon, and has a magnitude of plus 5.7. So in principle, it's just visible with the unaided eye from a very dark location, but I suspect binoculars will make it much easier. If you go to the night sky page on the Jodrell Bank website, or just put in night sky into Google, you should find it. I have a chart which actually shows its position mid-month. It's moving during the month down and towards the right, towards the star Beta Aquarii. On the 17th also, the asteroid Juno passes just 4 degrees to the lower left of Uranus, and I've given a second chart to show you where that should be. It's very close to a pair of fifth and sixth magnitude stars during that time. I should say that the different planetarium programs do sort of give a slightly different plot for where Juno will be. I've used Stellarium to find out where it is, but others I notice not quite the same. The thing to do is to observe the location on more than one night if you can, and see what has moved. Now, it's a slight pity we don't live in North America on August the 2nd and 3rd, so perhaps you could go there for a quick trip. Because there's a chance, which actually is quite rare, of looking at Jupiter and not actually seeing any moons at all. Last month, in fact, we apparently saw five because there was a star very close by. But this time, at that time, between 4:45 and 6:29 UT, that's when, sadly, Jupiter's set here, it will not appear to have its moons. Ganymede and Europa will lie in front of Jupiter, Io will be behind, and Callisto, although not behind, will be in Jupiter's shadow. And that's the last time it will appear moonless until 2019. So I'll bring it back up again in the highlights for that year. I've mentioned before that it's a good month to find the Andromeda Galaxy, and again on the Night Sky page you'll find a chart showing you how to find it. On the 12th of September, in the late evening, a crescent moon passes M35. That's the cluster in Gemini I mentioned earlier, because Mars is close by. As the moon and the cluster both have apparent angular sizes of half a degree, they'll be comparable in size, and the moon will just skim past the edge of the cluster. You'll certainly need binoculars, and of course there's a problem that the moon will actually produce some glare. So I think it will be a lovely thing to photograph, but somewhat tricky. You might have to take a photograph with a long exposure to overexpose the moon, but show the cluster, and then one to expose the moon, in which you wouldn't see the cluster, but combine them together, you could make perhaps a very nice photograph. And finally, Neptune. Now, we don't often spot Neptune. It's magnitude plus 7.8, so it's fairly faint. You'll need certainly binoculars, perhaps a small telescope. But it's due south around midnight, or has been at the end of last month. It's in Capricornus towards the south in the late evening. It's just over 2 degrees above the 2.8 magnitude star Delta Capricorni. So that makes it relatively easy to find. If you put Delta Capricorni at the bottom of the field of view of a pair of binoculars, then Neptune should be sort of towards the top. You can find Jupiter, sweep with binoculars, a few degrees between 4 and 6 to the east to pick up two stars, Delta and Gamma Capricorni, and then you'll find Neptune above. And I've given details and a star chart on the Night Sky page. So there are a few interesting things to look at, and I wish you luck. What if you're in the Southern Hemisphere? Following a little bit about what you see in the sky, I'll say something about Omega Centauri, which is a rather interesting object which might be of interest to those of us who live in the north as well. Well, if you look to the north, you see many of the stars, of course, that we see. Cygnus is low in the north, Lyra to its left, Aquila above it, the little constellation Delphinus between Cygnus and Aquila, a little bit to the right. Down to the left is Hercules. And in the northeast, the square of Pegasus, part of which would be visible. So there's a lot there that we've talked about on other times in the Northern Hemisphere. One thing you will see, of course, and I did actually see it from Rio a couple of weeks ago, is that Jupiter, of course, will appear much higher in the sky to you. So that's a good thing. If you look south, of course, you see that lovely vista where the Milky Way is sort of almost vertical, coming from the south-southwest up towards the zenith. Due south, obviously there's a south celestial pole, nothing there, but to the left of them you've got the small Magellanic Cloud, and below that the large Magellanic Cloud. Sweep around with binoculars on a clear night, you should spot them. I've talked about those in detail before, I think even last month. In the plane of the Milky Way, you see about a third of the way up from the horizon, horizontally, Crux, the Southern Cross. With binoculars or a small telescope, if you look at the highest of those stars, you actually find, very close, a lovely little cluster called the Jewel Box. That's certainly worth looking out for. Now, above that, we have the constellation of Centaurus. The two brightest stars, Alpha and Beta Centauri, are called the pointers because they point down to Crux. But this time, take Beta Centauri, the lower of those two, and then basically work your way towards the west, and you'll come to another bright star. If you carry on from Beta Centauri through the next star, and then continue in that direction, you should see something that looks fairly bright. It was once classified as a star, but also somewhat fuzzy. And that's in fact called Omega Centauri, which is nominally called a globular cluster. Omega Centauri was first discovered by Edmund Halley in 1677, who listed it as a nebula. But it actually had been spotted and listed as a star in Ptolemy's catalogue 2,000 years earlier. The English astronomer, William Herschel's son, John William Herschel, first recognised it as a globular cluster in the 1830s. It's one of the few globular clusters that can be seen with the naked eye, as both the brightest and the largest associated with the Milky Way, lying at a distance just under 16,000 light-years, and contains something like several million stars. They're very tightly packed in the centre, perhaps only 0.1 light-years apart from each other, whereas, of course, our nearest star is 4.2 light-years away. It's probably about 12 billion years old. Now, I think there's a lot of speculation to say it isn't really a globular cluster. All the stars in a globular cluster were formed at the same time. But in fact, you find several generations of stars in Omega Centauri. And I think most people now think, or a lot of people think, is actually the core of a dwarf galaxy where the outer parts were stripped off when it came close to the Milky Way. And in fact, last year, some astronomers claimed to have found evidence of an intermediate mass black hole at its center. Essentially, the stars close to the center are whirring around so quickly, you can estimate a mass of what must be a very small object. It does look as though it may well be a supermassive or a massive black hole. So I think our ideas now are changing. We're probably seeing the heart of an old galaxy. Well, do have a look. It's a lovely object to see.